Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Scroobius Pip. This is episode 104 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. And this week's guest is James Acaster, who's one of my favourite people to talk to. And my word, do we ramble on and on and on. It's quite a long one this week. It's one that I could have turned it into a two-parter, but I just thought, no, let's just keep going. It didn't feel like a natural break or a natural stop. So it's just a long episode. So anyone who's struggling for space on their phone, I apologise, but yeah, I don't like to just split them up. I've discussed this before. A lot of podcasts make them into two-parters because you get twice the amount of downloads and so on and so forth. But this one, it didn't have a natural break. I do that if there's a natural break and to give space on your phone so it's a smaller file. But it wasn't a natural break, so we just rambled on. Which means I should keep this intro shorter, really, shouldn't I? SpeechDeveloperRecords.com is normally the people I plug here and mention that you can come and support by doing that. But at the moment, the main thing I want to push is the Distraction Pieces podcast book and the Distraction Pieces podcast book tour. I've been blown away by the fact that numerous dates on the tour have sold out instantly. So thank you very, very much for that. But yeah, I'm coming on the Distraction Pieces podcast book tour. It's a lot of words, isn't it? In August, and it's starting on my birthday, August 3rd, where I'll be in London at the Leicester Square Theatre, and that's the big one. We're going to have a few previous guests there. I'm going to be doing a sign-in. Obviously, the book will be out a day early then, because it technically comes out on August 4th. So come along to that. That's at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's still some tickets left for that. I strongly urge you to come along. Then we're going to be in Birmingham on August 4th at Waterstones, then in Manchester on August 5th at Waterstones Deansgate, Edinburgh on August 6th at the Stand 3, that's one I'm going to try and record, and also on August 8th in Glasgow at Oran Moor, another one I'm going to try and record. And with the Edinburgh one, if anyone's about, I can drag up. I'll try and get an extra guest in there, but I don't know who's going to be about and timing wise and all that, but we shall see. August 9th, Liverpool Waterstones, August 10th, Bristol Rise Records, August 11th, Brighton Waterstones, and August 12th, the homecoming, Stamford Lee Hope Library, the town I've lived in for 35 years, because I will have had my 35th birthday on August 3rd. So yeah, come along. Probably don't bring cake or gifts, really, because the fact is, you're going to think the gift's really cool and quirky. It's probably going to be shit. No offense. It's like I'm going to be leaving that night and I'm going to have just a carload of shit tat. I like, you know, the small gifts you get at Christmas, like the Santa sack type gifts that you end up just throwing away. It's going to be like that, isn't it, really? And again, same with cake. I love cake, but this is a 400 cap venue. If you bring anything on the Leicester Square one on my actual birthday, if it's cupcakes, I'll go Doug Loves Movies. If it's cupcakes or donuts, I'll give them out to the crowd. I'll throw them at you. I'll share them. But yeah, I'm not encouraging you to bring stuff because it might get messy. But yeah, that's that. I told you I'd do a short intro to this podcast. Didn't I? Anyway, all the links and details to pre-order the book and to get the tickets and come to these live podcasts. To be honest, the ones that are sold out already, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. If you've got a copy of the book and if you're there, then we'll sort something out. If I have to come outside or come to a street corner or go and sit in a pub next door to get all your books signed, I'll do that. You know, so yeah, if you're coming to any of these, if the tickets aren't available, again, I'm not saying turn up at the scheduled time because they're probably going to be half hour to an hour, I guess, of conversation and signings. It could be longer, but yeah, if they're sold out but you've got a book, then we'll make it work, you know, just come down and we'll figure it out. I want to see as many of you as possible and sign for as many of you as possible. Let's get on with the podcast, eh? Ramble, ramble, ramble. This is James Acaster. I love the boy. I think that's recording. Hang on.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. I can hear us now.
Okay.
I'm joined by James Acaster. How are you?
Sorry, I had a mouthful of peppermint tea.
Yeah, I did wait.
It's bad.
I think I've also taken your coaster.
Oh no, there's a few. I mean,
interesting. One coaster. It seems like we've got loads of coasters
knocking about in this flat now. My flatmate Joe is very good at getting stuff like coasters.
Yeah. Here we go. You missed that one.
They all match as well. It's really, I mean, you can tell that this has nothing to do with me.
I was going to say, I'm very impressed already with your pad. The thing that jumped out to me instantly was the projector and projection screen.
So again, that's not me. But so everything in this room is like...
It's nothing to do
with
you.
If you're thinking, James is way cooler than I thought, you're wrong.
There's a wonderful DVD collection, good Blu-ray collection. I've just had an embarrassment of, I got Deadpool in the post today. Absolutely great. Loved it. Think it's great. Yep. Ordered it really early. Posted a picture of it, and everyone's asking about my 4K setup. Right. I've got a 4K setup. I ordered a special edition, thinking it was like one of them steel book ones.
Right,
that look
all
pretty.
Yeah.
I'll spend extra because it's a great film. I want to have it looking nice.
Yeah.
It's not steel book. It's just 4K. And
what's 4K?
It's like a fancy TV that's extra high res,
so you can't even watch
and
it.
Sound and everything as well. It's the one I've got. Says it's 4K, it's Blu-ray, and it's DVD.
Oh, okay.
So it works on anything.
Yeah.
But everyone's like, all tech nerds online are being like, wicked. Like, what's your setup? I was like, just a TV and a DVD player. Or a Blu-ray player, but yeah.
I was surprised. I saw the trailer for that, and I thought, nope, absolutely not. I'm going to hate it.
I love it.
So I didn't watch it. Yeah. And then on the plane recently, I was on a plane, and this wasn't many things I wanted to watch. And I thought, I'd put Deadpool on, it'll be a plain film. It's brilliant.
It's absolutely fantastic. And interestingly, you'll get joy out of it now if you watch it properly, because on the plane, they've cut out a lot of stuff.
Oh, right, okay.
Kind of weirdly, they've left in all the blood,
and
I think all the swears, but cut out any sexiness.
Oh, right.
And the sexiness in Deadpool isn't like, it's comedy sexiness. It's not like you're going to want to be on your own to watch it. It's a comfortable thing, but yeah. Interesting choice of editing rather
that's
than
the thing on planes. Maybe that's the thing. It's like, we cannot have people getting horny.
That was exactly it. I heard someone ranting about this on a podcast. I can't think which podcast. Can't for the life of me think. But I think that's exactly it. It's not about. It was Doug Loves Movies podcast, which is great. It's not about the gratuitousness. It's just people are watching blood is bad. Or is okay, but people masturbating on a plane isn't as okay. So I think it's more rather than a censorship thing.
Keep the vibe on the plane okay, and the general tone of the plane and the passengers not too sexual.
Although stewardesses are like an ultimate fantasy, aren't they?
People? Yeah,
they're made to be very attractive and sexy, and so there's a sexuality there. I don't know how we got onto this subject.
Already onto sexuality, and
I'll get onto my pre-prepared
questions. This wasn't pre-prepared.
That wasn't pre-prepared. I mean, I think you can imagine what my first question is going to be. I think you've answered it a million times. Why is there such a hard A at the start of your name? It's James Acaster. It's like
Acaster,
with again. It's not A again or about.
Yeah.
If someone says A again, they sound like a moron.
They sound like an idiot. Yeah.
Yeah. They sound like a fool. But it's not James Acaster.
No.
It's prominent. Acaster. It's Acaster or Acaster, depending on what part of the country
you're from. I don't know why. It's just always been, that's always what I've been raised as, that's my name. And so every time someone hasn't said that, to me it feels like, Acaster doesn't feel, that's not a full name.
It doesn't feel like a name. It feels like it has to have that punch at the beginning.
It feels like the end of something.
All my questions, I've noted the word area and about as the two examples. So area, it's not out. Again, area.
About.
Yeah.
It's not really, I can't think of any example where people just do that again, but
I couldn't find any others that have a hard A.
Other names with Caster at the end, it's sort of like Lancaster, and Doncaster's a place.
Yep.
And it's all just, it's a punch, and then the Caster can come afterwards.
Yeah.
And with my name.
You've got to get all that punch from one letter.
You've got to jump in.
Rather than from a full Lan or Don.
Yeah. You've got to go straight in there.
Do you think that's restricted you in your career or helped you?
Helped me.
That's going to be the main topic of the podcast.
Definitely just helped me. Yeah. Acaster has helped me. Just hit him with the name.
Yep.
And then you can use. But I mean, the main challenge, obviously, early on was following. you know, following that up.
Yeah, yeah, you've got that huge impact. The second prepared question was, do you have anything to do with Acast, who put my podcast out?
Yeah, I don't.
A great platform. I recommend them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very good. They were in all the financial papers a little while ago,
right?
And because I was the first kind of podcast to push them and to get out there on them, all the financial headlines were Poets Podcast, or the big one in the Financial Times thing was Poets Podcast Platform gets $5 million investment, and a big picture of me. So it looked like I'd had a $5 million investment, yeah, which I hadn't.
Yeah,
I hadn't.
And that's very off brand.
But yeah, I wondered if that was anything to do with you.
But I think the
you.
First time someone did a tweet with both of us in it was because of that.
Yeah. Oh, really?
So I think you tweeted about your podcast and Acast was in there, and they went, yeah, "Tell you who should get on it." Yeah. Just because of his name.
Straight away. It makes sense, doesn't it? And finally,
is that Acast or Acast?
It's Acast again. It's that hard A. That's the only. It's to try and they must have named it to try and make you feel more comfortable.
Yeah,
try and bring another thing in there that's Acast. A team.
Yeah,
but there's a dash. But
yeah, A bomb.
A bomb. Yeah, it's not.
But it has a dash.
Not always positive, is it? I'm looking up at your DVD collection now, because it's in alphabetical order, which
Joe's done that.
Or Joe, it's not what I do.
Can't blame it on Joe enough.
I choose to, if you could let Joe know, yeah, I organise mine by colour of the box. So all the red boxes are together, all the white boxes, all the black boxes. Honestly, it's a good way to to run things. It looks beautiful.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how themed it is. So the white with red writing section, generally kind of comedies and stuff.
The black
spines are always quite moody. A black and red or black and white writing, always quite thrillers or dramas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do mine normally director or something like that.
Nice.
I just clump those together.
That's good. I like that. I like it when there's either actor or director, a little section for.
Yeah. I recently bought, about to go to Edinburgh, and sharing a flat with a load of other comics. So every day we're going to watch a different film club together.
Oh, fantastic.
And we're trying to decide what films to choose. Quite hard to...
Yeah.
Or decide on ones. We're trying to think of a theme so we could just surrender ourselves to that. So
that's always fun.
We're watching the last 28 Best Picture winners for the Oscars.
Nice.
So we're going to do that. So that's a nice mixture then, because you get
really
a nice
good
mix of stuff.
I was going to throw a recommendation in there, and I reckon it will get the Oscar next year for best foreign film, even though the bulk of it's in English, because it's a German film, but the lead characters are one's Spanish and one's German, so a lot of it they're speaking in broken English, and then the subtitles when they're talking to their own friends. But a film called Victoria, which is another one I got today.
The one take one.
Blew me away. All in one take. And I hadn't really realised it was a one take one, which is weird because I'm obsessed with one takes. I hosted the one take short awards. I've done a load of videos that are one take, but man, it's a beautiful piece.
I tried to go and see it before a gig. I didn't have enough time. It was going to overrun, so I watched Son of Saul instead.
Was that good?
Really good, but a really intense film to watch just before you go and do a gig.
Yeah,
and try to make people laugh.
I'm doing a tour to promote my book that comes out in August, and I'm going to be making it up to Edinburgh actually, and hopefully I'll come along and catch your show. But on that, I'm really excited because I'm doing it on my own.
Yeah.
And Odeon recently sponsored the podcast, and they gave me a limitless card,
right?
Which is just free films, and you can buy them as a season card.
Sweet.
They're really good value, but particularly with how expensive the cinema is these days. But my excitement on that was I've got to do a book gig type thing every evening.
But
I've got the whole day to travel from that place to that place. I can just find an Odeon.
Yeah.
And watch films all,
that's the
all
dream
week.
Although you will, how quickly are you going to run out?
It's August, so
you're
going to have all the summer blockbusters out. I've seen already that Suicide Squad comes out while I'm doing it, and that might be a double viewer. It feels like it's going to be one I could watch twice.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm quite excited about that. But let's get back to you, maybe. Shall we do that? I don't know where to start. I've been on your podcast / radio show / TV show numerous times.
Yeah, you're the person who's done it the most.
I've done all of them. I did.
Well, you did the podcast, which was also on the radio, and then you did the pilot, the taster episode for the feel a bit grandiose calling it a TV show because it is online show.
But it's BBC Three, and BBC Three is if they hadn't recently switched online, which incidentally I think is a great thing. I know there was a lot of save BBC Three. I think they're going to bring the BBC into the modern world because of this. Because I do think with Netflix and Amazon Prime and Fight Pass and the network and all these different things, TV's moving online hugely. Yeah. So I think the BBC suddenly having this whole online channel with really good stuff. I like Murder in Successville.
Right,
like,
you've
changed the name of your show. Well,
don't get
you?
Me started on that. Yeah, they changed the name.
Yeah, because I
didn't decide that name. I think you probably knew when you saw it. That's not a...
What is the name of it now? Hang on. I want to find it.
Yeah.
Sounds Random.
It's called Sounds Random now.
Yeah, but that's good still.
It's all right. I'm not a massive fan of it, but we had to call it something.
Yeah.
And but there's more people than just me who get to decide these things. So.
It's something fun. I really like. I'm not painfully polite, so if I didn't really enjoy it and really enjoy sitting down with you and talking about music, I wouldn't have agreed to have done it so many times. So it's a really good concept and idea. So basically it's you get a guest in and they put their iPod on shuffle,
yep,
and we just see what comes up and discuss.
Preferably that's discuss what happens.
Tracks. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes that wasn't what happened. Sometimes people had cheated and made a playlist.
Right.
And with a lot of those people, you could tell pretty early on. I'd say, every now and again they do that and I'd kind of go, this is a playlist, isn't it? And they go, yeah.
I'll be honest, I made a playlist, but it was only to exclude all the stand-up I've got on. And like as you will have seen, if anyone's listened to the podcast version, or hopefully all of you will go and watch the BBC Three version, it's not like I had a slew of cool songs coming up.
Yeah,
that's I had some really embarrassing.
Yeah, and that's a different one. It's like, you know, you just took out the ones that are
stuff
like
that wouldn't be usable.
Voice memos and stand up.
That was exactly
it. You did it so it was all the music on your iPod and you put it on shuffle.
And the first time we did that's it, fine. I just started auditioning for stuff and getting into acting.
Yeah.
And the way I was learning lines would I'd record myself. I had no one to practice with. I'd record myself in the other role and leave gaps and talk back and forth with myself. And I almost couldn't sleep one night thinking about, if one of those comes up, I'm just going to feel so embarrassed and be going,
I would have
scene
been
four. Would have looked like such a wally. So that was the
lot behind it. I'm okay with people just going, right, it's all the music on my iPod and let's put it on shuffle. Some people were just making a playlist of 10, 15 songs.
That they've got cool anecdotes and about.
That's the thing. They didn't.
They didn't. They're just cool
songs.
So
this made them
look
cool.
This.
So like one person at one point, a song came up and I was like, I hadn't heard the song before. So we listened to it. I was like, yeah, it's a really good song. How did you get into this guy? I've never heard of this guy. And she was like, oh, I heard it recently. So last night I downloaded it to put it on the playlist. And I went, what? And she went, and she realised, oh, shit. I was like, so literally you have no story about this. You heard it this week. You thought, this is a cool song.
It's a cool song.
I put it on here. I look cool. But I've got nothing to say about it.
I don't think anything came up on my shuffle that was in... Post the turn of the millennium. I think all of mine was
You had Young Fathers come up.
I had Young Fathers come up.
What was nice about doing the series was you're doing it with the same crew and the same dancers as well. Yeah. We had dancers reenacting
stories.
So we'd have, we had four or five, maybe? Yeah, five contemporary dancers on rotation who would reenact the conversations we had a few days later.
Yeah.
They'd also do dances to the songs so that we had like almost music videos to cut to all the time.
Amazing.
I was really proud of those bits and really liked them. And the people doing the dances were so good and so good at coming up with stuff quickly. And there's a choreographer called Josh who was really good at that as well. What was nice is that we would, obviously, this meant we all heard these songs way more than you guys did.
Yeah,
we had to just listen
to
them all week.
Yeah.
And like, you know, do stuff over and over again and people get favourites. And that Young Fathers one was one of the favourites of the... We had 15 guests, remember?
Nice.
And that was definitely one of the favourites of the series that people really liked. There was that one.
Fantastic.
And I think someone, that Rub It On My Belly Like Guava Jelly song came up, which was by, I think, someone, Nash. I can't remember that, but that was quite a highlight.
Yeah.
It's a really nice, really happy song.
I like that, and I like that you've got, I love, again, that element and that that weirdness of it, the oddness of them interpreting our conversations or the stories, because basically what it tends to spawn, or what I guess you hope it spawns, is some stories or some memories of when you first heard it, or to do with when you were growing up or whatever else.
Yeah.
And again, every time that we've done it, it's not been repeating the same stories. It's been kind of just
even when similar bands come on.
Yeah,
you know, you still have other things you can say about it. And I think when it's genuinely on shuffle as well, you can really tell the difference between someone. You can see them and they're sitting down and they're looking quite nervous.
Yeah,
and then the song comes on and there's either this. And there's just a rush of something in them, because either they're relieved or they're embarrassed or whatever it is. And then they've always got something to say about it.
Yeah.
So even like when it's someone they're not particularly into low, but they instantly have to justify why it's on their iPod. What it's doing on there. There'll be a story about that if it's not something they're particularly into.
Yeah.
And they'll have something to say about it. Whereas it's weird that if it's prepped, they've almost got less to say.
Yeah,
because they go, right, and now James Brown's about to come on.
This next one and that's is it. James Brown.
Yeah, and they go, this is James Brown. Yeah. But like, if it comes on, they're like, ah, because then they're just so happy that they get to look cool.
Yeah,
because James Brown's come on shuffle.
Yeah, and they're quite story.
Enthusiastic and get to just talk about
it. Yeah. I like it. So, who are a few of the other guests you've had on? Because I know the day that we were doing, you had a Billy Bragg coming in.
Billy Bragg's coming
in. Which instantly I was so like, that's going to be fascinating, because he's such a nice and interesting dude, but equally, he's not someone you'd... That's why I'm excited of you having a show on BBC Three, is Billy Bragg isn't someone you'd instantly think of BBC Three producers to pick. Yeah. Oh, let's get Billy...
Well, they didn't pick him.
Billy Bragg on. Exactly, so it's that interest of getting some more.
Yeah, he was great. Really just like... You know, he's got a lot to say about music and stuff, so whatever came up... Also, I don't think he made a playlist, but he was completely unfazed of whatever. He wasn't nervous. He was sitting there going, because he's not going to be. He's Billy Bragg. He's like, I don't care what comes up.
Yeah.
Like, you can't embarrass me.
Yeah.
I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts came on at one point, and he was like, yeah, great, absolutely owning tune. It. And just like, talking about how it's a good song. Sang it at a karaoke once with his son. Big Nasty came on.
Nice.
Who, Big Nasty just, obviously famous for getting high whenever he can.
Yeah.
That's his brand.
That's mainly his brand.
Yeah, it was no different. And because we had beanbag chairs.
Yeah.
So seeing a very high man on a beanbag chair is a sight
and
to behold.
And he's not a small man.
He's
consuming that beanbag chair, I'd
imagine.
I did a track with Big Nasty years ago.
Yeah.
It was with Akira the Don and Big Nasty and Eddie Argos.
Yeah.
Weirdly. And I loved him. And I think I'm so glad he's blown up more and more.
Yeah.
Like, just popularity-wise. Because I think so much of his appeal is just him.
Right, yeah.
Like, I'm a big fan of Big Nasty. There's not particularly a one song that I can say, oh, this is it, but I like everything I hear of him, and I just like him as a weird little character.
Yeah, he's funny, but he's also like... He was one of those people who, whatever came up, he had something to say about it. You can tell he's probably thought about things in his life. He can go on for a long time about music to you, which is really good, like having proper music chats with people that people maybe don't expect it from, and stuff like that. And I mean, one of the frustrating things with the series in a way was that it was very short episodes,
right? Yeah, of course,
because it's online, so like we had to cut out some stuff which I was really chuffed with. And like, cause we had to get certain people on, so we had I should remember his surname really, but Tom from The Wanted who are like, you know, a boy band who, like, I think he knew that I wouldn't really listen to him or anything like that, but the chat was, he was fascinating, and he had so much to say about how it's actually quite rubbish being in a boy band a lot of the time, and, you know, writing songs for radio isn't very fulfilling and things like that. And I was, I mean, and then the edit came in and like, I mean, we can't put it all in.
Yeah,
and I wish we could just have that whole conversation, because it was really, when you get people like that talking about music, it's really interesting. And also on the flip side, it kind of exposes certain people as well when they're put in a position where they have to talk about music and they got nothing. And you're like,
they're not really into it,
and it's not who you'd expect as well. There's certain people you go, I thought you'd have a lot to say, but you don't.
It's one of the things I think that was nice that we instantly connected on, was almost a youth of music that you wouldn't particularly it definitely wouldn't be on any I want to look cool playlist.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a lot of stuff, I think I had Alien Ant Farm come up on one of them and things like that we were like, and a friend of mine sent me a thing recently because Alien Ant Farm are playing at our local venue in November, Chinnery's. I went, lovely. You'll love that. And I was like, mate, they're being supported by Head PE, who are also adored, and I've seen both of them before. I was like, I genuinely can't wait for that gig. That's going to be amazing. But again, I'm being sent in by mates who are trying to mock me, going, all right, you'll enjoy this. Like, yes, I will enjoy this.
I will enjoy it. I really love it. But when I went to see Limp Bizkit, I thought I was doing it ironically until they started playing. I was like, this isn't ironic. I love this.
Mate, and there's good stuff. It was weird. This is a bit of a name drop now, but someone who I've been working on bits on my next record with, I don't know if we'll get round to doing anything, is Wes Borland.
Yeah.
And we chatted a bit online, and I was in LA, and we were going to meet around my mate Danny Lonner, who was in Nine Inch Nails and producing Tradition. We were going to meet around his, and he was being a bit flaky. And Wes just said, look, do you want to just meet up and have some lunch? I was like, yeah, cool. And because we've been chatting that much, it was similar. It was all casual. It was like, it's no big deal. As soon as I got there, I sat down. I was like, that's Wes Borland. How fucking awesome is this?
Yeah.
You know, and again, there was some absolute tunes. Break Stuff, I still maintain, really is fun. One of the most emotive songs ever written.
He's one of my heroes. I think no matter what I will ever think about Limp Bizkit my whole life, it's bound to be a point where I go, no, just none of it, not at all. But like, whatever I think of him, I will always think he's a legend, and always be like, just to see, I think seeing people doing their own things, a lot of the time, you know, it's quite easy, you know, solo artists or comics or something like that, and you see them doing their own thing, but you rarely see someone in a band who is still doing their own thing compared to the rest of the band.
Within the band. And that was the fascinating thing. I had him on the podcast, and it was fascinating hearing him saying at the time the kind of conflict of that was Limp Bizkit blew up with the kind of frat boy crowd. And Wes is kind of your art student type guy. So it was a really... He found it a weird thing to be this guy with crazy face paint and body paint playing to loads of drunk frat boys, all with their Fred Durst caps on. It's like a really weird, conflict and juxtaposition. I still get all the time, there's a Rammstein documentary in which they interview Wes and he's wearing a Scroobius Pip t-shirt.
Ooh.
And people send me it all the time. Yeah. Every time I'm still like, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Happy to be reminded about that.
Yeah, exactly. So your musical upbringing, I mean, first of all, I went on your wiki, as everyone does, to get some information.
Someone's had a field day on there recently, so I was going to say, not true.
Are you anything to do with it?
Because
there was so much nonsense on there. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it got brought up to me recently.
It's absolute nonsense. For some reason, I assumed it was your nonsense, because it's so... It's like, it says about you being born in the Congo or something and raised by...
It's quite in keeping dingoes or with something. My general brand, so it's kind of all right. Someone is interviewing me and said, is it true you were struck by lightning? I was like, no, where's that come from? And then there's also on your Wikipedia, so I went on there, I was like, oh yeah, someone's absolutely...
They've gone to
filled their boots.
It's a good read, though. I recommend people go and have a read. But the thing that got me with it is there's fact mixed in with the fiction. So things like people you've gigged with or things like that are all real... But then it'll also say just really weird, bizarre, surreal stuff. And it's like, man, this...
The cleverest one they've done is that they've added one fake band name in with the list of bands I used to be in.
Brilliant.
So, and you can't quite tell which one it is, because they're all stupid names.
Yeah.
So, like, they've just added one stupid name in with a bunch of stupid names.
I love it. So what I really took from the notes there was... you grew up in Kettering.
Yeah.
Is that accurate? Please tell me that's true.
Yeah, that is true.
No, that's a... That's fictional. You grew up in Kettering, and we've discussed before, you were kind of... You grew up in bands and making music. What kind of bands? What are some of the actual band names, and what kind of music and that were you kind of...
Yeah. Well, in order... So the first band was, I think it was when I was 15, it was called Pin Drop. And that was a new metal band, and that's a classic new metal name.
Pin Drop's a great new metal name,
classic. Matthew Butler on guitar, who was a big Joe Satriani fan.
Nice.
And we never really settled on a vocalist, so all the songs were like new metal songs with a really big, fancy guitar solo out of nowhere. Like, I mean, noodly guitar solo.
I mean, a lot of people would say in a band that the vocalist is a key a key point. Like, you'll often have a band that the same vocalist and the band changes around a lot.
Yep.
How did you have a band that didn't really settle on a vocalist? Did you?
We just had a different vocalist every gig. They would all also there weren't any set lyrics to the songs or vocals to the songs. So they would all do their own vocals to the songs, so it would change. And so it was the same backing track with someone doing their own interpretation of the song over the top of it.
I mean, that's hugely indulgent as a band. Yeah. I mean, the lyrics and vocals, that's not really important. You do what you want to do, but the key is this four chord guitar line.
What we're doing. I think our final gig was just no vocalist and just us doing instrumental new metal songs with guitar solos in them.
I bet they went down a treat in Kevin.
Oh, people loved it. And then we closed weirdly at that gig. I remember we did all our own songs, and then at the end, me and my brother, who was the other guitarist, just stayed on stage and played Albatross by Fleetwood Mac.
Nice.
But completely, like, not a new metal version, just as is. Just did it.
Beautiful.
And
I like that. Did that go down well?
Yeah, well, that went down better than everything else. Like, this, you know, a middle-aged couple just started dancing to it, really happy that we were playing it.
Nice.
And
it feels like that thing where sometimes you'll have someone like, I mean, Brian Gittins is an example, but Neil Hamburger, more someone like Neil Hamburger, where he'll do a whole load of appalling jokes and then he'll have one that's actually a really, like, the point of the purpose of appalling, he'll have one that's really well crafted and it'll just hit so hard and it'll be great because you've set them up to expect this thing. And that feels like you did that there. It's like, let's do 20 minutes of instrumental new metal. And then, I mean, it's intriguing because you'd say new metal is a combination of metal and rap.
So
you've taken out the rap element, but it's still, I love it.
The drums were quite hip-hoppy. And,
I like it.
Yeah, maybe the bass and stuff. But, so that was the first one, and that lasted about a year or whatever. And then I was in the new hardcore skiffle movement, who were
Of course you were.
Yeah, we were just a hardcore band, so like each song was about a minute, and we listened to a lot of Nerve Agents and stuff around then, and so it was that kind of stuff. Not quite Minor Threat, more like Nerve Agents. It's more like Nerve Agents, so it's that kind of stuff. And that band was together for a little bit, and then it was Three Line Whip after that, which was a post-hardcore band.
Three Line Whip.
Yeah, Three Line Whip. It was a political term that we didn't understand. Right. We just decided to name ourselves after a political term.
Perfect. I'm happy with that.
I still don't really understand it. But so that was just like almost the same lineup as the new hardcore skiffle movement, but with more singy vocals.
Mm-hmm. So, I still love the new hardcore skiffle movement.
Yeah.
It's just it's a hell of a movement there.
A very good band name.
Is that all of them? How many bands were there? This is a great list.
It's like five, I think. Because then there's the Capri Sun Quartet.
Oh, that's a hell of a name.
Yeah, who we all drank Capri Suns off stage, not on stage.
Not on. I was going to say, that's got to be, that's got to be part of your on stage.
Yeah, absolutely didn't do it.
Vibe, just to get it over, but
should've done that. No, just off stage, drinking Capri Suns in the canteen at college. And that was a folk funk band.
Brilliant.
So my friend B was a folk singer, and a bunch of us just became a backing band, and we decided to play really funky backing to it. And then the band I was in for the longest was called The Wow Scenario, and was me and my friend Graham trying our best to reinvent all of music any way we could. It was a real big... And I really don't regret this part of my life at all. I'm quite happy that I did it. It was, I don't know if you've ever had this, when you just kind of go, there's no point at all in doing this if we're not going to change everything. There's no point. And I don't really share that view as much now, maybe, but like at that point, we're like, everything has already been done, so we're going to do something different. And like, just the act of trying to do that.
Yeah.
I think it's very, we just get a lot out of it, and it moves you forward
freedom.
As a person.
It's that freedom of, well, we're not trying to do this to be the new this or the new that, therefore the only goal is to do it, and then once it's done, it's a success because we've done it. I
still don't know if we did it, really. Like, when we decided to stop doing it, we recorded an album because we didn't want to lose the songs. You know, every time you abandon it afterwards, you go, oh, I wish we had those songs now. Yeah. How did that song go? So we thought, we'll record it, but professionally. And there was this guy called Chris who had met who wanted to record us. We had to go to Hawley, which is like in between. It's like, I don't know, it's near Crawley. But we went there and just spent, we lived there for a month in this studio.
Oh, wow.
Sleeping on the floor in sleeping bags and recorded a 17-track album, which lasted.
Serious?
Yeah, it lasted 71 minutes, this album. And we just spent every day recording. And it was one of the most fun months ever. I loved it. And I realised at that point that what I loved with music was recording and nothing else. Like, I really loved recording songs. And after we'd done that, I started doing stand-up because I was like, I don't really want to get a band together and do gigs anymore.
It's a fascinating thing because it's a completely, it's weird to people who are in music, but that's a completely viable outlook. I'm sure on one of the versions of your show we've done, a Giacomo Brown came up,
who's
on my label, and he's one that confuses people because he's similar in that way. He had some songs. I had to twist his arm to even record them.
Yeah.
Isn't into to playing live. He played two live gigs, didn't see the appeal. And I have people all the time, because that album went down really well, and I have people all the time ask, like when's the next album out? Is there going to be a tour? It's like, no, I don't think he's got any plans to make any more music. That was his goal. Yeah. And it was similar with the label, exactly as you were saying. People, I remember a year later, asked, like, how'd that record go?
Yeah.
And it may be that I'm a bad label manager, but I was like, I haven't really paid attention to sales because our goal was to make the album or what we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
To have the artwork how we wanted it to be. Mm. And all of that happened. So kind of a month or so before it was released, we'd already achieved our goals because we'd made it and we had it in our hands. We're like, this is exactly what we wanted it to be. So it didn't really matter that much what was to come from it.
Especially now, you can record something and you can just put it online.
Yeah.
And you can do that, and then you go, well, if it's not your main thing, if your main thing isn't that you're a musician and that's your career, you go, well, I've made this thing, I'll put it online, and people will find it if they like it. And if they don't, they won't. And it's quite a nice, especially when, you know, your job is something creative, where you are trying to move things forward and accrue a fan base and stuff. It's quite nice to have something that you go, that's another creative thing I do, but just purely for fun, and whoever likes it, doesn't matter.
Exactly that. And I have people all the time ask me if I'll look at their poetry or listen to their music and tell them if it's good.
Yeah.
And I always say no, because number one, I'm terrible at creative criticism and that. I never grew up reading poetry. I've never been taught how to do any of it, so I've always just written. And my advice to them is always, look, if you're excited to share it, it's probably achieved like what you needed it to achieve. If you're not, then maybe it's not done, or it's not quite there. And again, that's tough because it might not be applicable to everyone. But it's like, that's all I can tell you, because the fact is, I could read this and hate it.
Yeah,
that doesn't mean it's shit. It could be the best piece of poetry ever. I just might not like it.
Yeah, and also I guess rejection and failure is all part of it anyway. So if you've made something and you want to put it out there, and you just have that desire to put it out there, you should just do it. And then there's a chance that everyone will go, this is absolutely awful. Yeah. There's no way that Rebecca Black could know that Friday was an awful song.
Yeah.
Unless she released it, and then everyone went, this is an absolute joke. And she's like, oh, okay, I probably won't continue with this. And then you know, and then it's part of it. Or,
it's one of the most played songs on YouTube, though. So, you know, fair play. There's
not
some
a total failure.
There's some genius behind it all. Yeah. It's interesting, all of this that you're saying here, because I had Tom Rosenthal on last week, and we recorded it on the same day. And you used to, you lived together the first year you both did The Fringe, right?
Yeah.
Or
was
it the first year up there properly?
The first year we did solo shows. Yeah. So, like, we'd both been before doing, like, little 20-minute spots here and there.
Yeah.
And this is the first time we both had our debut hours.
One of the things he was saying to me after we'd recorded it was something he found really inspiring about you. Was it felt like you were kind of comfortable to walk away from comedy or whatever else if you needed to. It didn't feel like there's such a thing in comedy and in music as well. That it's like, I need to get on this show and I need to do this, to do that. And he said it was so calming that it seemed that you were like, I'll do this, and if it's good, it's good. Mm. If it's not, it's not. And he was saying you'd worked with, I can't remember if he said children in the past and stuff like that, and done stuff outside of comedy that was for other jobs that are fulfilling that you can go to if you choose to.
Yeah.
Not again, and again, that's fulfilling rather than I've got a load of money in the bank, it doesn't matter. It's not that. It's a case of I've got other things I could do. So, but I think that can be a great thing because it takes a bit of the pressure off and allows you to just go, no, I don't have to do. And The Fringe is a perfect example of it. When often people will be doing 4 or 5 gigs a day because they're so nervous that they're going to miss someone and they need to pull everyone in.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's not the best way to do it. Sometimes that's going to diminish the important gig that's your headline show because you're going to be burnt out quicker or whatever else.
Well, I think
I've just rambled for about 10 minutes under the guise of it being a question and then just looked over at you to hand it back. So go ahead.
when I was in bands, I was definitely the kind of person who was like, this has to work. This has to, I want to make this work forever. I want to be in a band that is remembered for the rest of time.
Yeah.
And this is how many albums we're going to do. Yeah. This is the festivals we're going to headline, and everything's planned out. My whole life's planned out, and these are the things I want to achieve.
Yeah.
And then when that stopped, and I kind of decided I didn't want to do that, and I started stand up, and it wasn't like I didn't have a plan. It was just like, oh, I was going to do this for a while, and originally it was like, oh, I'll do stand up until I think of a better idea of what to do in my life. And then I grew to really love it and enjoy it. But because the way that I started out was with like, oh, we'll see what happens, it did mean that my attitude towards stand-up was really different to how I was about music.
Yeah.
And that I feel like I'm doing what I want with it even more because I'm like, well, if you don't like it, then I don't have to keep doing it. Or if there's no point, especially with stand-up, there's no point living this lifestyle if you don't enjoy it. The amount of other things that it stops you from doing in your life.
It's not a breeze. And the music industry, like anything in the entertainment industry, it's similar. It's put on a pedestal as this amazing thing, but it's also a very acquired taste of a lifestyle and as a way to live. As you said, you have to give up a lot of things. So if you're doing it thinking it's a quick fix or a quick success, it's like,
yeah,
it probably isn't the one.
Yeah, and like, there's no point giving all your evenings are gone. Like when I started doing stand up, I had to just write off my evenings.
Yeah.
I wouldn't see my friends as much.
Done.
All that. I'm going to be on my own a lot.
Yeah.
And so unless you really enjoy your actual stand up, there's no point.
It's really interesting because what you've said there again, I think, is going to be something that's allowed you to grow into the comedian that you are and have the comfort to do what you do. And it's the thing that you came into it going, you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So you didn't come into it thinking, I need to try and get success in this way. You just did your thing. That then was successful, which then gives you the confidence, I think, to continue to just do things your way, to be you, to be your kind of comedian, to do your kind of comedy or whatever else. It gives you that confidence because it worked the first time.
Yeah.
It's got you to where you are now, if you know what I mean. So you don't then have that thing of, right, at this point, I need to become a McIntyre type comedian or a Jimmy Carr type.
Yeah.
He's gag.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't have to have that because you've got to where you are off the back of it.
A bit more. So you do learn to trust your gut more. And but also, you know, I had to almost, with stand-up, I had to learn to compromise more as well with my act. Like, when I was in that final band, it was just uncompromising. We're doing exactly what we want, and everyone else is wrong.
Yeah.
So whatever anyone said to us, we were like, nope, you're wrong, we're doing this, and this is what we... Yeah, and, like, one of the only people who ever wrote back to us was Zane Lowe, and he was like, I like the songs, but I think you need to, like, focus on the melodies a little bit more because there's melodies in there and you're not really pulling them out. We're like, shut up, Zane Lowe, let's carry on going. And now...
That's crazy. That's wicked, though, that there's someone like Zane responding and giving an articulate
Yeah.
Here's what I think isn't working. Here's what I think is working. That's amazing.
He really loves his job and he really loves music. But with that now, I'll listen to those songs now and go, yep, I agree.
Completely
absolutely
right.
Need to pull the melodies out more. But at the time, it's like, no, we're not going to compromise. We're not going to ever put ourselves in the shoes of the audience. Yeah. So it was never doing that. And with stand-up...
And that's a silly move, isn't
you
it?
Kind of have to.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like stand-up, you're on stage and you're like, well, they're not laughing, so there's got to be something going on here.
Yeah.
And like, and so you have to go, right, if I was in the audience listening to me doing that, how would I feel? And what... And why is this not coming? So it's less like, you know, it's like a compromising in a way that you're not going, well, I'm going to start talking about this stuff because I think people want to hear about it.
Yeah.
But you are going, the way I talk about it, that's what I've got to learn. I've got to learn how to communicate and articulate the ideas in my head so that the image in my brain that's making me laugh is in theirs as well. And I can project that same thing into them so that they're not there. Because otherwise, you just use the wrong word. And it's just the same in poetry and lyrics. That you use one wrong word and it's a different image in their head than it is in yours. And it can be, you know, not funny, or worse, it can be like, you know, disturbing or upsetting, you know, because you just use the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And they don't know, you know, to them, that doesn't mean the same. And also just the way you perform it and, you know, the persona that you've got surrounding the whole thing as well. So all the elements and learning how to do all that so that you can then be a bit more uncompromising.
Yeah.
So learning that whole language of stand-up and just communicating in general. And then when you learn that kind of stuff, you kind of sympathise a lot more with people when they get in trouble.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
Especially online and stuff like that. You go, they use the wrong word.
You can just understand how they've made... They've slipped up there. They've made an error. Just everything you said there makes me think that the Edinburgh Fringe has probably been quite important for you then, as a place of learning, because it is somewhere where you're thrust into it. What was your first experience of the Fringe? When did you go up there first?
It was 2008. I've been doing stand up for about 6 months.
Yeah,
well, no, a bit longer. I've been doing stand up since January. Fringe was in August, and I didn't know that it was such a big deal, the Edinburgh Fringe. I think I'd heard of it, but I didn't know it was such a big deal. I hadn't really made many friends on the open mic circuit yet because I lived in Kettering and everyone else lived in London. So I knew Josh Widdicombe and Nick Helm were my friends.
Yeah, they're both great as well.
Yeah, they're amazing. But like, we're all open spots at that point, and I'd like started to forge friendships with them, but didn't know them well enough.
Yeah.
And they were all going to Edinburgh, and I suddenly realised, oh, they're all doing it. They've all got accommodation. They're all going for the month. I didn't know this was a big deal. I didn't know it was a thing. And I was like, I guess I'm not going then. And then someone who I used to work with in a kitchen just said, oh, you do comedy. Don't you start doing comedy? There's these coupons that were in the Express today just for, you know, coach tickets to the Edinburgh Festival. Do you want these? And so I was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. So I booked 2 weeks off work at the last minute. I couldn't get any accommodation. So I borrowed a tent off a friend and decided to camp in this field that was about... It's a 20-minute bus journey from the festival.
That's amazing.
And I took the coach there, and that took 12 hours on the coach to get to Edinburgh from Northampton. Because we had to go back into London and then out. It was pretty ridiculous. And got there, set up my tent, and the field that I was camping in, it's the Edinburgh Caravan Club site, I still remember it. And for some reason, all the caravans were on high ground, and all the tents were in a bowl-shaped field in a dish.
That doesn't lend itself well to how the Fringe can be with heavy rain.
With heavy rain from day one. So on the first night, my tent got flooded and all my belongings got flooded immediately. So that was like straight away. I didn't have any gigs booked either. Everyone else had shows that were booked in, and they were all doing, like, you know, they'd be like, all the open micers, they'd get like them and two of their mates or three of their mates, and they'd book a room on the free fringe where people don't have to pay to see you, and you just do you work on your 15 minutes or your 20 minutes all month, and you do it like that. I didn't have any gigs in the diary, so the first day was just me going around and finding the open mic gigs that had a different lineup every day.
Right.
And going up to them and going, do you have any spaces that I can fill?
Yeah.
So the first day, I think I did one gig, and that was because it was a free fringe gig where they didn't have a compere. And Sean Walsh was one of the acts on the bill.
Right.
And he had done a gig with me just before Edinburgh that I'd gone well at. So he was like, well, just MC. None of us want to MC this. You can MC it every day. So I managed to very luckily get that. And Sean doesn't remember. I spoke to him about this recently. He doesn't remember that I MC'd this gig.
Who are you?
With him in Edinburgh. Like, he was just like, you didn't do that. It's like, I did that every day. Like, for 2 weeks.
That's amazing.
I MC'd it every day. I saw you every single day. He doesn't remember it.
I love it.
So I got that, and I started doing gigs. And by the end of the first week, I was doing 6 gigs a day and going around and just doing 10 minutes everywhere. And
I mean, that's an amazing thing. I mean, I will let you continue, but that's an amazing thing to highlight on the work ethic and drive front of, you've gone up there with no gigs booked, you're living in a field,
yeah,
and pretty quickly you're doing 6 gigs a day. Yeah, you're putting that grind and effort in.
But that thing of, like, no distractions in a way as well, because, like, as I say, I didn't really have many mates in the company. So I think Nick was doing two or three shows a day.
Yeah.
Because he had, like, but they were, like, required a lot of work, because he was doing a play that, you know, he had to organise a cast and loads of props. So he's doing 2 stand-up shows a day. Josh was doing the same. And they all, like, hung out with other groups of people, and I didn't have any gigs, so I was just like, I'm just going to... So, because I didn't have any distractions, I didn't have, like, mates going, we're all going down to the pub at lunchtime, do you want to come with us? I was just like, I'm just...
It can be a great headspace, right? The one you I did, The Fringe, I knew a few people, but I'm not... Because the comedy scene is so linked, I'm not part of that. So I knew, I think, Brett Goldstein and one or two others.
Yeah.
And it was amazing for me, because I was living on my own, and I got so much writing done and so much productivity, because I'm getting to go and see Brett and Tom Rosenthal and just so many great people, and then just be inspired. I'm doing one show every night, and it was weird because people always ask me to jump on these multiple lineups. I'm like, I can't do that because it's spoken word. It's a different thing. Yeah. It's particularly, I got asked to do the late
Late Live,
which I would have been the worst at. And I went to it a few times. I was like, I'm never getting up there, because it's great, but it's a tough gig, even if you're a comedian, because it's a lot of drunk people, often a lot of comics who've had a tough week or whatever else. And I was like, you want me to get up? Yeah. And again, it's weird, because in my set, I went down well with the comedians, because it was kind of billed as a poetry set, but in between I had written gags and I had written comedy sections. But it's like, but that's also specific. That's not stuff that can translate. That's to get from one poem to the other. So that's not going to work on a...
I did it once late in life.
Yeah. And how was it?
All I said was the names of TV presenters, because all that happened from the moment I walked on stage is they shouted out names of TV presenters. So the whole U-Tree story had kind of...
Right.
Was new, fairly new. And I walked on and someone shouted out Andy Crane, because they thought I looked like Andy Crane.
Right.
Fair enough. And I just went, Andy Crane, yeah. So then someone just shouted out Pat Sharp. I went, Pat Sharp. And then they realised this is a game. So they started going, Andy Peters. And then more, and then they started doing people who were on the U-Tree list. So I started doing those people. And then it was almost, if I wasn't so tired, I think I would have thought, this is quite fascinating, actually. And there's some people who are in the audience. Amanda Redman, who produced my radio show when it was the Shuffle Show, and you met her.
Yeah, she was currently doing Jeff Lloyd's show on Absolute, which is
Absolute
fantastic.
Radio, yeah. And she, that's the first time she saw me, and she loved it, because she just thought it was fascinating that it was me going on, and I was doing nothing, but the mood in the room was changed by the audience, just like veering it from a bunch of nice celebrities into, oh, it's a bit dark now, and then out to some really, and there's a surreal section where it was just really weird celebs that they were throwing out of nowhere. And all I did was just repeat each celebrity, and then looked at my watch and went, that's 15 minutes, and then said, see you later.
Easy gig, right?
And that was
it. There was a guy up there the year I was up there, and I never got to catch it, but I genuinely heard from people. It was absolutely amazing. And he was just... it was something like John lists everything.
Yeah.
And he was on for half hour every day, and he was just...
Oh, yes. It was...
listing everything.
Was and that it was, Alistair Tremblay Birchall?
Maybe.
Is that him?
Yeah.
Birchall.
Yeah, it could be. And it was... He never listed the same thing.
Yeah.
And from what I heard, it's not like he went into detail or riffed off of them.
Yeah.
He'd just list stuff.
Yeah.
And again, I can completely see how that could become hilarious, just depending on what comes up next. Again, as you said, going from dark to light, seeing those natural progressions.
Alexis Dubas is a comedian, and he also does a character called Marcel Leconte, a French character. Very funny.
I remember when I was up there, he was doing the whole Fringe with no venue.
Right, yeah.
You could just book him.
Right,
Because his character was very much, I'm above all this. Yeah. It's all nonsense. It's like, you can arrange for him to come and perform on this corner or in your flat or whatever else.
He had so many good ideas, Alexis. And and he's one great year on the Free Fringe, he just did a show where the show was him in a gorilla outfit, sat in a rocking chair, and that was it.
Brilliant.
So the audience show up, and the show was called A Young Man Dressed as an Old Man, Dressed as a Gorilla, Sits in a Rocking Chair for an Hour. And so the audience make the show whatever they want. So after about 10 minutes of realising he's not doing anything, they get up and they see if they can sit in his lap, and they can, or they see if they can, like, rock him on the rocking chair. Someone does a little dance on stage where their mates clap, does that for an hour, and then at the end of the hour gets up and walks off, and that's it. And the whole show is just whatever the audience do. It's kind of a comedy version of John Cage or something like that.
I love it. But it allows it to be itself.
But my first Edinburgh.
So you did. The reason you were doing six shows a day.
But like, the reason why it's so important as well was that I absolutely had not found my voice at all at that point. I've been doing it for 6 months, and there were other comics who just, they had something early on that enables them to find a voice quickly. So using Helm and Widdicombe as examples, Helm had done he'd written plays and performed as an, you know, in his own plays for years. So he had a lot of experience performing, playing different characters on stage. So his performance was just great. He's really good at performing. Josh had been writing, doing a lot of journalism for years, so his writing was really good and really tight writing.
Yeah.
I'd just been in a band, so like, I didn't really have anything that I was good at. I could improvise.
And there was a little period there where there were so many people that were coming through that were new, that were all like that, Carl Donnelly and Ramesh and a few others in that, all seemed at that time that were just appearing, who, as you said, all just seemed to have it figured out as characters. And again, their actual sets would all be down to individual taste or whatever else, but they seemed to have their things. So that must have been an interesting thing to see.
Yeah, and you go, oh, I can see, like, it was really like Helm watching him progress over the, you know, and him just like being the big character that he is in the open mic circuit, where often you get very apathetic audiences, meant that he developed this persona of being like, you know, shouting, get on board, and like, I'm not going to pull your good time out of my ass, and stuff like that, because that was funny in that situation, which is why for a long time there's loads of open mic comics just copied him, because the environment of the open mic circuit makes you want to do that, makes you want to shout at the audience, and he was the first one who just going, I'm just going to do it.
And he was great because, again, it was also at a time where the panel shows were blowing up, so many comedians who hadn't got that big were getting on TV.
Yeah.
And he was one that I got to watch develop more on TV, because I remember the first time he was on 8 out of 10 Cats.
Yeah.
He was generally just shouting, and that was it was hilarious, but that was mainly his thing. And as it's gone on, he'll be on there just being hilarious, and there'll still be that intensity, and there'll be almost the implication of everything he's done before. He won't have to shout once, because you'll know that it's bubbling there. And that's kind of great to watch things like that. And characters develop in such a way. But you obviously had to find your
voice. Well, I didn't know what I was doing. I could improvise, weirdly, because I think I'd had enough bad gigs with the band that I'd had, often, like, if the guitarist had loads of pedals and stuff and different tunings, so while he's doing all that, I had to just speak in between songs and stuff. So, like, I could improvise my way out of a bad situation.
I love the thought of these gigs being instrumental with a little dash of improvised stand-up in the middle.
But just me dealing with hecklers a lot of the time. me getting shouted at, you guys are shit, and then me having to come back at it or whatever. So I could improvise. I couldn't really do anything else. So, like, for a long time, I was like, oh, why? And when you're an open micer, suddenly, like, you know, you don't understand anything. So you have a bad gig, and you're like, you go home and be like, why didn't they laugh? But you have a good gig, and you actually don't think to ask this, but you don't know why they laugh.
You should think, why did they laugh?
Why did they? But you just come away going, it's because I'm great.
Yeah.
Because I'm really funny, obviously.
Because I smashed it.
But, like, you also don't know. There's no rhyme or reason to evil. You don't know. And so,
Do you record much of your stuff?
I do now, yeah.
There's a great thing on Netflix. I thought it was just a new Hannibal
show,
but it's him at the Fringe.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic because he almost has a breakdown and he hates it a lot of time. And I remember, I'm sure it's the year I was there because I remember seeing him do a gig. Yeah. Yeah. That would have been the one I was there. I remember seeing him do a gig and feeling, I'd listened to a lot of his CDs and kind of, he did an open mic spot. I think it was at Richard Herring's, one of Richard Herring's shows. No, in the same venue that Richard Herring was doing his Leicester Square thing. So maybe not the show, but he seemed like he weren't enjoying it. He seemed genuinely, this is shit. And you watch that development. But in that, he talks about how he wishes he had recorded his shows from earlier on because he realises how he'll notice the nuances of what works. Like, as you were saying, he'll listen to them laugh and go, right, actually, it's because that sentence had no fat. I didn't It was very much bang, bang, bang. It got to the point quicker than the sentence before, which was maybe a funnier concept, but I was so all over the place to get there, it didn't have that same impact. So,
well, that kind of stuff, now I can do that with my stand-up. Back then, it was, I had even further to go, because it was literally, I don't know why I'm funny. So, like, I don't know what it is about me. Because what you have to do, especially in, I mean, I guess in any kind of form of anything creative, you've got to find your own voice. But with comedy, you really can't get away with ripping off anyone. Yeah. No, I don't mean just like ripping off material, but I mean also like their act. If you start to act like someone on stage, people just go, you're just doing that. Like, that's what, you know, people can slag off mainstream comics to their heart's content, but no one performs like Michael McIntyre does.
Yeah.
Like, he has to come up with his own original style of performance suits him.
And the problem is, it's also so natural to mimic or find influences coming in of stuff that you enjoy.
Yeah.
And even just from going to see a stand-up show, that next, even on the journey home, if you're not even talking about it, some of your timing and delivery on just joking with your mates will be reflective of the style that was on stage. So that must be a thing you have to be really conscious of and aware of, because it's like, I'm not, so as you said, not even intentionally ripping off anyone's material or anything like that, but just not becoming and someone
kind of,
else.
Yeah, becoming someone else, but also, like, you know, definitely adopting their sense of humour sometimes. I was, you know, that was the thing about, you know, my first 6 months of stand-up was that everything was just different things I found funny. And I liked loads of different stand-ups.
Yeah.
So within one set, there'd be, you know, a really lovely bit that is like inspired by Josie Long or someone that was, you know, it's quite a whimsical story.
Yeah.
And then the next routine is kind of shock comedy because I liked, you know, Ricky Gervais or someone who would chuck stuff like that in. And I'm not as big a fan of his stand-up now, but like at that point, everyone on the open mic circuit was watching him, and you were kind of, you just saw it everywhere. We're all suddenly doing a joke about something that,
something
really, and I had offensive. To have a moment where I was like, hold on, would I say that ever in real life?
Yeah.
This is about me and who I am on stage. This is it's supposed to be an interpretation of me and not, you know, other people I find funny. And if it doesn't suit me to talk about that,
it's really interesting because two of your bigger, or I'd imagine impactful, support slots early on, from what I know, was Josie Long, as you mentioned, and Milton Jones.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because style-wise, again, they're almost, although they're both, you could say both whimsical in a way, style-wise, they're so different because Josie is so off on tangents, long rambling stories, and Milton is so gags, so such punch.
Yeah.
So that must have in a way been a good thing because you can't, it would have been good, I'd imagine, to stop you being influenced too much in one direction because you're doing tours or whatever with two such on the same area of the circuit but such different nuances and styles.
Yeah, and it was one after the other. So Josie was the autumn of 2010, and then starting in January was Milton's tour. So
amazing.
I did Josie's tour until December, and then had like a month for Christmas, and then straight on tour with Milton for a
year.
And what was good about that was that was my first, that was my first bunch of gigs as a professional comic. I was on the open mic circuit, and then Josie rang me up and said, do you want to support me on tour? I couldn't believe it, really excited, and got to quit my job because I had to go off with her on tour.
Amazing. So, what job were you in at the time?
I was a classroom assistant at a school for autistic children.
Amazing. So it wasn't a flip a desk and spit in the boss's face type job, but still it was an exciting...
Yeah, yeah. I was happy to...
I'm joining the circus, guys. This.
Yeah, yeah. It was really... I remember one of the guys... everyone there at that school was really supportive and really lovely. One guy, he kind of said to me... He was kind of a bit disappointed in me. It's stuck with me still, and I still feel guilty now sometimes. If I'm not enjoying stand-up or it's going badly, I think I should have stayed at that school. Because that guy, at the end, he kind of went to me, what are you doing? I was like, I'm just going to go and do stand-up. He's like, we need male... These kids need men working with... Like, there's not enough men working with autistic children. Like, they need male role models and people around. Why aren't you doing that? You're good at this.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just want to do this. I'm going to go on tour. We're one of my favourite comics. And he was like... Well, how big is the tour? Are you going to play the Apollo? I went, well, no, we're not playing the Apollo. And he went, well, I'll see you in about 6 months.
And, it's harsh, man. That's quite cutthroat.
Yeah, it was quite... I mean, at the time, I just thought... To put it in context, when I started that job, I was a temp.
Yeah.
And I didn't know I was going to be a temp. I thought this agency had got me a job.
Right.
And so on day one, when I was told, we'll let you know tomorrow if we need you, I shat myself because I'd just moved to London. So I moved to London. I only had a grand, which would cover, you know, first month's rent and food. And then I'd have little... So I was like, shit, I need this job. And he was the guy, he was classroom assistant, who took me under his wing the first day and told them, he's good, you should bring him back. And so he kind of got me the job and eventually it became a permanent job. So I think that's why at the end it was a bit like, man, I really kind of... Yeah. He didn't say to me, I made sure you got into this.
For you,
but I think it was a bit like, this is, you know... And so I can kind of completely... I understand why he said that in the moment, you know?
It's an interesting thing, and it's something... I can't remember if I've discussed it in the podcast a lot or in real life a lot recently, but the term selfish, it's seen as a dirty word and a horrible thing.
Yeah.
I think... there's a level of selfishness that we all need to survive or to achieve our goals or whatever else. And that was a thing there. Maybe what you chose there was selfish, but it was completely the right choice because it's something you needed to try or needed to have a go at because it's what you wanted. Otherwise, there would have been resentment and everything else. And
the only reason I moved to London was to do stand-up. I've been doing gigs... while living in Kettering and just commuting all the time, and it cost me £25 on the train every time. I was staying around people's houses and then kicking around for a whole day with nothing to do in London. So I was like, I've got to move. So I'm doing 5 gigs a week in London now. So I've got to move there.
Yeah.
And in order to move there, I had to have a job there.
Yeah.
So I had to start working. So the only reason I was working at that school was to do stand-up.
And you know what? I absolutely adore that it was Josie that was the catalyst there because it shows... the intention and ambition there because Josie isn't this massive make millions huge she's a career comedian in that it's her career but she's never had that big TV show or anything else and she will have so much stuff but she has always been one of the best there is since she broke on the scene at 16 and things like that. So it's great that it was someone that you could that you artistically couldn't bear to say no to, rather than someone financially or whatever else has said that's doing Apollos,
you're going
to be like, well, I can't say no to that. It's like, no, this woman's amazing.
And she's one of the reasons I started stand-up. I went to see her in Northampton and was like, great, you can talk about whatever you like.
Yeah, it's similar with me and Dan early on when we were talking to labels in America and we were talking to Rick Rubin at one point and some huge deals and Sage Francis showed an interest who's one of the people I'd started doing this because of and Strange Famous is a small independent label. There's Sage and Storm and a handful of other people but there wasn't a question about it. It was like we're going with Sage and everything I've done since then has been on Strange Famous regardless of how big or small it is. And it was exactly the same thing. It's like, right, we're not just going to go, oh, we're going to hold out for the most money, the biggest offer. It's like, this is someone I'm excited to be associated with.
Yeah.
And to get to support someone like Josie, regardless of the size of the venues or the pay. I'd imagine the pay wasn't a life-changing.
I know, the pay wasn't going to...
Particularly as a support slot.
That was the thing as well, is that quitting the job, but like I wasn't going to financially make enough money that would make me a living.
Yeah.
Like I had to move all my stuff back to my parents' house in Kettering while I went on this tour. The only reason was that I quit the job is because I couldn't do it because I was away. Yeah. But doing her tour and then Milton's in that order was perfect because with her, so with her audience, they love innovation and they love people being, because they're just going to see her. So they love someone trying to do something new with comedy and completely. So when I,
it's not
I was
necessarily
on those,
about a polished set. It's about the experience.
Yeah. So with those, I was like, right, I can't just do stuff that they can second guess. So I've got to do, I'll talk about these subjects. They won't think that they would see it in that coming. They probably haven't heard that before. And I'll do it in this way or whatever. So it was really good for just making me try and talk about unusual things or whatever. And then, is then Milton's tour, who obviously they really like jokes and crafted gags like that. So when I was then on tour with Milton, I had to take the same material I'd just done with Josie's one and tighten it all up and make it all have, like, put a joke in there. So it's the same routine.
It's great in that order,
but it's
then,
got
isn't
a joke
it?
In it. So it's perfect.
To have that tour of Josie's, not, it sounds disrespectful to say to have it as a warm up, but in a way, it is that thing of a tour where you're allowed to have the material be quite loose and quite baggy and figure out how it works and where it sits to get to the Milton one where it's this tight put together thing.
Yeah, same routine, same subjects, but just, right, that's got to have a joke there and that's got to have a joke there and do it like this. And those two tours were definitely instrumental in finding my voice. The other gig that was instrumental in finding my voice was in that first Edinburgh when I... there was a gig that my friend Richard Rycroft ran, who was a stand-up, and he said it's at noon in Leith, which is a bit far out of Edinburgh. I turned up and no one showed up. And it was just Richard and another comic called Cal, who's quit now. And that was because it's the bill, basically, the lineup for the gig. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess that's cancelled. And Cal went, I've got a gig later. I've got to do a competition and I've got to have my 5 minutes for this competition. So it'd be really good if I could just perform it to you guys. I was like, yeah, okay, it's fine. And he's like, can you guys do 5 minutes as well so that I don't feel stupid? I was like, oh, I absolutely do not want to do 5 minutes to you two at noon in Leaf. And but because he had asked me to, I did. And I thought, well, I'll just do... There's a story that I had that I'd never done on stage before.
Yeah.
And I'd never done it because I thought, people won't get it. It's too specific to me.
Yeah.
People won't understand it. Because I've been trying to do for 6 months what I thought other people thought was funny.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'll just tell this story. I'll just do it because who cares? And they both really went for it and said, you should do that. Have you done that before? You should do that all the time.
Yeah.
And then so I started doing it every day, six times a day. So it that festival. And it became my first bit that never failed.
Brilliant.
And I had to then go, right, why is this never failing and everything else is failing all the time?
Yeah.
But what is it about? And it was a story about me bearing a grudge against someone for a long time and being really petty. So it was a longer bit. So it's my longest bit. So I was like, so one of my things was like, okay, you're good at doing long bits. Maybe it's long bits. And the story shows you. For a while, I thought, because the story showed me in a negative light, that was the key. So for a while, I started writing loads of routines that were like really negative, like almost confessional, and that didn't work.
Yeah.
But I thought okay, that's not it. And I was like, because it's about me being petty. It's a really small, me picking up on small things. So I started doing that and that worked. So me picking up on small details and making a massive deal out of them worked. Me doing stories worked. And I just kind of like started to figure out that was part of it. That was part of getting it somewhere. And it had a bit of imagination in it as well.
It's fascinating to get to break it all down. And I think, again, I bang on about the wonder of the fringe on here a lot. And I generally get a point to mention that you can buy my 5-star sold out run at the Edinburgh Fringe for just £5 at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. It's a wonderful download there, or the DVD. But it's an amazing place for honing things. And yeah. It was interesting because, as I said, I had Tom on last week and I saw his show early on at the Fringe, like my first night there, in fact.
Yeah.
And it felt finished.
Yeah.
And there's a variation. People like Tom, people like Brett Goldstein, it feels like they turn up and it's one long story and it's polished and it's got all its marks and all its beats in there. But for other people, it's more let's try this out, let's change that, let's move this around, more of a work in progress, which for those people, you can't get a better scenario because you're doing it over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's great for that. And like definitely for the first few years of going on, when I wasn't doing solo shows, that's what it was every year, especially that first year. That first year, it was just, I came out of it and I had improved so much. Yeah. And then I think a year later was when I came out of Edinburgh and went, oh, I want to do this as my job now.
Yeah.
Like it took a year and a half.
Yeah.
But then after that second Edinburgh, I was like, yeah, I feel like this is what I want to do.
Yeah. We're well over the hour mark, so I'll start to wrap things up. But are you there? I assume you're there this year.
I am, yeah.
What are you doing? That I need your venue and time and everything else, but what's the show? What are you doing this year?
So the show this year is called Reset, and it's about how we all want a fresh start in life.
Yep.
And we'd all like to start again. And the... It's a lot of like, actually, I mean, I didn't really think about it. I mean, it's weird, really. That thing about that guy saying that to me when I left the school.
Yeah.
I think I just hadn't thought of that, but that's quite relevant to the show almost. Yeah. It's me thinking maybe I should have done something less selfish. Yeah. Maybe there are other things I could have done that I should probably be. Am I a good person? I should be a better person. But my shows are never kind of like, so it's not me talking like I am now about things. You know, my onstage persona is something of a high status idiot, so like and also it's never,
but it's brilliant. I loved you. I loved you on Sunday brunch.
Oh, thanks, man.
Sorry to take you off track there. And I messaged you instantly because of your wonderfully relaxed arms. As soon as it came out to you, there's two of them. There's Tim Lovejoy and I can't remember the other guy's name, but he's great, on one couch, and you're just arms up, relax, hi guys. And it was just great because as you said there, I was like, I love this because that's you were almost in your stage persona when being interviewed, if you know what I mean. It was very much,
I had one foot in it, definitely.
It was great, that kind of just the openness and just
especially touring. With that interview, because he was asked, Lovejoy's asked me questions that if I gave serious answers to, it's gonna not for, it wouldn't fit on Sunday brunch. Yeah. He asked me, you know, all sorts of stuff.
I loved it. It was perfect though, because it didn't come across as I'm too good to be here kind of thing.
No, it's great. I loved being on it.
Because shows like that are really interesting, and you see it with a lot of that kind of show where there's bands or whoever will be on who feel they're a bit too cool for this. It's like, well, don't go on then.
Yeah.
But the perfect thing there, as you said, was, it is the kind of show where they have to ask kind of quite obvious questions and things like that, because you're going to be new to most of their audience.
So yeah, absolutely.
It's not a rude way. It's just, well, we need to ask these things. And it was just perfect because your answers were all straight away as if you're easily the biggest comedian on the circuit. Massive. You've made it. You don't really need to be here, but you're being here out of the goodness of, to give their ratings a bit of a bump.
Great. It was a lot of fun messing around with them. And they were really nice people as well. I quite enjoyed it.
So
this show is kind of the final, the third in a trilogy of shows, but like that sounds so pretentious to put it that way, and none of that's deliberate, by the way. It wasn't a deliberate trilogy. I wasn't going to write a trilogy, it's going to be this. But so I did a show 2 years ago called Recognize, which was about it was me talking about how I'm an undercover cop, going, I've been undercover as a comedian for 6.5 years, so and busting people that are dealing drugs backstage at comedy gigs, but the show was really about how when I get to the end of relationships, I kind of go crazy. I don't know who I am anymore, and I have an identity crisis.
Yeah, that's, so I mean, that's That's fascinating, because you do... There's a Fernando Pessoa quote where he says, we never truly love anyone. I'm paraphrasing. We love a version of them that we've created in our heads.
Right, yeah.
Which I think is completely true, and I think we also, all as humans, facilitate that. Mm. And to be quite blunt, you can highlight it with the fact that you maybe don't fart in front of your girlfriend,
yeah.
or you act around your mates in a different way to you act yeah. around your girlfriend. Therefore, you're putting forward a false version of you.
Mm.
And it's not, again, it's the same as I was saying, selfish shouldn't be this horrible word. There's levels of it that's right. It's the same in that. A bit of changing is, in many ways, it can be a respectful thing. In many ways, yeah. it can be a, oh, she deserves better than...
Yeah.
Than I am.
Yeah.
It's not a case of, I'll trick her into thinking I'm a nice person. But it is also completely true that when it ends, if you've been living that for a long time, it is hard to know who you are, what bits were the person you want to be.
Yeah.
So are you doing that because that's how you wish to be, or yeah. was it just to please someone else and all that? So
I'd get quite
it's a fascinating
needy.
Area.
At the end of relationships, I found that I'd get very needy because of that. Because it kind of mirrors with stand up in a way. Like, so when I was starting out, and I was just guessing what other people found funny.
Yeah.
And then I had to start going, oh no, this is me, and this is what. And then I had to present a more honest version of myself. And a more confident version of myself. This is what I find funny.
Yeah.
And then gigs started going well. The same with relationships is that if I was always guessing what the other person wanted me to be like, then when it's kind of started going badly, yeah. I'd get very needy because it'd be like, what do you want me to do? I don't know what
just
to do.
Just tell me how
I
to be.
I don't know because I haven't yeah. been doing my own thing all this time.
Yeah,
I've been like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think it's kind of that show was about that, about how afterwards you just kind of go, you know, try and figure out what you did wrong. You don't really know how to act around people anymore. So that was that show. And then the next show was called Represent, which is about doing jury duty on a double murder case.
The first one was called Represent, wasn't it?
The first one was called Recognize.
Recognize, then Represent.
Then Represent.
Sorry, yeah.
It's very confusing.
No, it's fine.
Second one was called Represent.
It's funny because you said Recognize, and I instantly thought, oh, that's the same name as the Ronnie Size album. And then halfway through, I realized, no, the Ronnie Size album is called Represent.
Yeah.
That's why I then got confused when it's Represent. It's like, oh, no, I'm having the same thoughts as last time. But yeah.
Yeah.
So Recognize and then Represent.
Then Represent. So Represent's about doing jury duty on a double murder case.
Wow.
And again, was completely made up. And,
oh, man.
But no.
Jury duty is the best. Have you done jury
duty? No, I've never done
it. Real life? It's brilliant. I love it. And you're not meant to talk about it, but
yeah.
I don't give a fuck. I had one where they had to ask the judge if they could ignore me, essentially.
Right.
Because in general, in jury, in court, you have to get 100%. So all of us have to be agreed
right.
on a verdict. And I wouldn't agree with them because
right.
the people that I was on a jury with were fucking idiots.
Yeah.
And it started that it was about, say, I think it's 12, isn't it? So it started that it was like, yeah. say, 7 and 5.
Yeah.
So there was 5 that agreed with my kind of way of it. And the thing that was annoying me was they were gradually going over to the other way because
yeah.
they all wanted it to finish.
Right.
And that annoyed
yeah.
me. I was like,
yeah,
again,
yeah.
it's the whole... I won't go into great detail
yeah.
because it's boring, but it's the whole yeah. reasonable doubt thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, I felt you can't deny, with my view of the facts that we had, that you can't deny that there is reason to have doubt. That it's basically that this kid could see this person
yeah.
when they kicked a door in.
Yeah,
You can't tell because of, again, it's boring and it's maths.
Yeah.
I'll discuss it as I'm packing away. But yeah, I wasn't having it. And they all started to go over because they didn't want it to go to another day.
Right.
And they wanted to drag over. And I had to go into court the first time and ask if they'd accept a majority rather than a 100% thing. And they had to ignore me.
Ignore
they
you.
They all hated me. But
well,
yeah.
I'd never stand on your ground.
Well, yeah, I'm a stubborn prick in many ways. But it was just, I was like, well, no, it's the weird thing with our legal system. Because
yeah.
it's not asking you if you think he's guilty or not.
Yeah.
It's asking you if there's reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And again, I thought the kid, he seemed like a bit of a scumbag. And,
yeah.
the situation, it seemed like he wasn't right.
Yeah.
But it wasn't asking me that. asking you if there's reasonable doubt, and there's 100% reasonable doubt. But anyway, that's just hijacking your.
But it illustrates almost what the show is about a bit, because like, that show was about doubt and and certainty, and essentially about me being raised Christian and losing my faith, and, and as an adult being agnostic and actually quite missing it, missing feeling certain about something and missing believing in something.
I love that.
So, and the whole jury duty thing was obviously just the thing about that, about not being certain about the case and getting frustrated about it. And,
yeah.
And things like that. And then this set, this show is about how I'm about to, so Reset is about how I'm about to go into, I'm about to join the Witness Protection Program. But the show is about how I want a fresh start in life and why. And the things I wish I'd done.
I love that.
And so, yeah, the last three shows have just been quite a nice. They've all been involved with the legal system. So lies that are about the legal system.
Brilliant. What more could you ask for?
That are a way of me talking about something personal.
Yeah.
Because I and that's something you just learn with your persona and stuff. Like, I can't just go on stage and immediately talk about personal stuff, and it doesn't fit my persona.
I get that. Completely, and this is the last time I'll do it, because I feel early on in the podcast, a few people said that I'd always try and bring things back to being about a story I had, which I hate, which I don't do. I like people talk, but in this one, again, it's because, as I said at the start, of us talking about a music the first time, there's so much that is relatable between our upbringings, between our, and again, even on the fact that I was brought up a Christian and I'm not anymore, and all these kind of things, but it's similar there in people assume, a lot of people praise my work for the openness and how honest I am about stuff, and every song I've ever written is fiction except for one, and it's like, it's exactly the same thing. It's like a lot of it will be rooted in my own personal experiences, but for me it would feel cheap and almost exploitative to go up and go, as you'll see a lot of comedians, it'll be, oh, I had this ex, and it'll all be about an ex. It's like, I'm enjoying this, but if that's a real person, I don't know if I'm enjoying it as much. Do you know what I mean? Because it feels exploitative to go, well, this is, you know.
And also, like, what I want to do is kind of like, I don't think, as far as the audience are concerned, I don't think it's relevant what's true or not.
Completely. In comedy, in particular.
Yeah. What it is really, it's just how they feel about it. So if you can do something that they identify with, and it's just, it's how best you can sum it up. So if you are one of those people who's really good at talking, I saw this really amazing show at the Melbourne Comedy Festival called The Cane Toad Effect by Corey White, and the whole show's true, and the whole show is about his absolutely depressed life, and very sad. There's a point in his life where just like, a good period of his life where only bad things happened to him, and it was really awful, and it's all very personal, and it was just, it suits him to talk about that, and you hear it and you just completely get swept up in it, and it makes sense. And I think if you're not one of those people, you almost have to make people feel the same way in a different, you figure out how you make people feel you know, a certain way. And like, I just wanted to write stuff that they could relate to, and so I just thought, it doesn't matter the details of, like, for that first show, for example, for that Undercover Cop show, the details of my breakup aren't relevant to these people. Mm-hmm. What's relevant, I think, is that I haven't seen a stand-up talking about how in a relationship you can feel needy and you start to question who you are. I haven't heard that breakup show yet. I've seen a lot of breakup shows that all do different angles, and then my favourite ones are the ones that go, yeah, I do feel like that, and no one's talked about that yet.
Yeah.
So I was like, I want to talk about how they feel, and how we all fit, and the shared thing.
Yeah,
and
it's wicked.
How my individual little details of my relationship aren't important.
Yeah.
So I may as well say I'm an undercover cop for the whole thing, who doesn't know who he is anymore.
Exactly that, because the fact is, it's all about their experience anyway. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's hearing what you're saying and going,
yeah,
I'm now thinking of my own experiences of that. So it doesn't, there's a selfishness as an audience member, in that you can go, I can relate that to my life.
Yeah.
Therefore, I enjoy all that much more. So it's not important.
You like photos of yourself in them.
Yeah, yeah.
Facebook, you know,
lets
you know when you're in a photo.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't let you know when someone else, you don't care.
No.
So, like, you want to go and see a show because there's so much stuff, especially with laughter, is not feeling alone.
Yeah.
And just going, like, I'm part of a group. We're all laughing and it's safe. We all do that. I'm not the only one who does that. I don't feel alone anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's a big part of it.
And that, I think, I say that all the time. Do you know what I mean? But it's done in a way that you couldn't do necessarily. Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, I think with these three shows, there's the three kind of, like, things. There's the complete fiction of whatever it is, mm-hmm. jury duty, witness protection, whatever. There's the personal side, so, like, you know, I went for a breakup, or I was raised Christian and I don't know what, you know, and I kind of miss it, or I wish I'd gone to Kenya, which is this new show. And then there's this the proper just what we all, the shared experience thing of, like, we all feel like this when we break up with someone. We all wish that we were more certain about the world and life, and we all sometimes wish we could just start again.
Yeah.
And I think it's doing those three things is the formula, at least for these last three shows, and that's why I feel like they belong together.
Have you... another thing that always... And again, I spoke to... I only remember such specific ones because they've ended up in the book, but I remember speaking to Stuart Lee about The Fringe and how weird it is, how in the moment a lot of it is, that there'll be an amazing show, it exists then maybe you'll tour it, but then...
Yeah.
The next year, it's all a new show.
Yeah.
Are those, as this is a trilogy, are those ones recorded? Are they available? Are they...
I'm recording them next year.
Great, so you're going to do the trilogy?
Yeah, I'm going to do all three of them.
That's fantastic. And that makes sense. Because again, there's a lot of it I discussed then that I like the fact that these things only exist for those people there at that time.
Yeah.
But when it's a trilogy that kind of sits together, you kind of go, well, I've got on at this point in the trilogy. I want to be able to get the first two books and know the rest of it.
So. And also for me, it's just quite nice to go back and, like, so for the first show of those three, I didn't really have, I just had, you know, a mic and, you know, a table on stage. And then for the second one, for last year's one, because of a certain joke that I was doing in the show, which involved me being very heavy-handed with the mic stand and throwing it around, I had to get my own mic stand. So I thought, I'll just get a custom-made one. I wanted it to be red because I was wearing all red on stage anyway. So I was like, well, I'll just get it so it's all red and the mic will match it. And then in Edinburgh, like... the stage is a bit too deep, so we got a curtain that was also red to cut the stage in half.
Brilliant.
And then I was like, oh, I wish I'd done this with the last show. I wish the last show was this, because the last show
You can find those improvements.
So now recording it, I can go, right, I'm going to go back. And, like, so for this new one, it's the exact same set as last year, but in yellow.
Amazing.
In, like, an autumnal yellow. And the first show was, I had a green jacket on and a table that I... found one of those card tables and those poker tables that is the same colour green as my jacket.
Brilliant.
So I'll just make the backdrop and the mic stand all green for that show.
Yeah.
So I get to record them and have it like a Wes Anderson style.
Yeah,
like
that's beautiful.
That deliberate thing.
Are you familiar with Rob Alton?
Yeah, I love Rob Alton.
I love Rob, and he's at The Fringe again this year, and his shows, again, he did the Sky show, the Water show, which I didn't catch, and he's face. Doing the Sleep show, the Face show, and
Yellow
again,
show.
It's a similar thing. If it's just here's a theme, but then just it made me think of it because his set will just be the sky; it'll just be blue everywhere, and things like that. And
it's great.
He's a great one, and again, a shout out. He'll be at The Fringe. He's normally on the Free Fringe, and he's one of the best.
Absolutely,
acts
go
I've ever
and
seen.
Watch
he's
him.
So amazing.
Yeah, I always recommend him every year, and he's not quite like anyone else because he does mix stand-up and poetry in a way that is seamless rather than... It, so you can't really go, oh, is this bit a poem or is this bit stand-up?
Yeah,
because it's
just watching
a guy. Flow. So
yeah,
like,
completely.
It's not like... obviously, so many acts that I love who do poetry, but when Tim Key starts doing a poem, you're like, oh, this bit's a poem.
Here's the poem.
And now this bit is stand-up. And
I agree.
With Rob, there's that thing of like, you're just watching a show and you go, well, I kind of... If someone just told me you were going to see a poetry show, I would have come out and gone, yep, I saw some poetry.
Yeah.
And that was a poetry show that happened to be
just
funny.
Go and, see, and you've just seen a Rob Alton.
Yeah.
That's all you can kind of say.
Yeah.
It's Sky show, I think I saw it at least four times. It might be more. And it's the most I've seen any show. And it was because there were points in it that would crack me up. But there was also the big ending he had would make me cry every time.
Right.
And it blew me away. It's like, I know this is coming. I know what this is, but I would always tear up. And I was like, I will pay for that experience as many times as you want to have that laughter and elation and just just in wonder at the weird man that's on stage, just being an odd person. But then for him to then be able to take complete control of my emotions and go, right, here's where I'm going to take you. Every time I was like, I watch it all the time.
Yeah, and he seems to be, again, it's that thing that's very rare, and it's very, I think other performers find this attractive in performers as well, and get very drawn to these kind of people. He's just very self-assured in what he's doing.
Yeah.
And so he's, you know, even if he's not, he appears that way. He appears like...
I was going to say, it's self-assured, but with a real humbleness about it.
Yeah, and still that vulnerability.
I sent Brett to go and see him.
Yeah.
Brett Goldstein that year. And he came away saying, number one, is brilliant. Yeah. Number two, he doesn't know how good looking he is. And he's like, genuinely, he didn't have the arrogance of an attractive man or an attractive comedian.
It's such a Brett Goldstein thing to notice. Goldstein notices that about everyone, how attractive they are, and like...
But again, it's a weird one, because again, he's a very attractive, and I hadn't thought about it, but he's an attractive dude. But again, there's a complete lack of awareness of that. He's not a comedian who's up there like, I'm a good-looking guy, I'm funny, I've got all this going for me. He's just up there doing his weird little thing, kind of assured, as you said, assured of what he's going to do, but unassured of if it's relevant to anyone else in the world other than him in that moment.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's that weird
kind
mixture.
Of, like, doubts himself sometimes and thinks, oh, maybe this isn't good or whatever. But certain performers like him are still like, well, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And at times we'll think, oh, maybe it's shit. Maybe I should quit. I don't know what this is. But it would keep on... He would have to work very hard to make himself do something that he wasn't 100%
completely,
behind. And there's a comic called Sam Campbell, an Australian comic, who's going to be at Edinburgh this year doing his debut show.
Yeah.
And I gigged with him. I did a week with him in Sydney. There's a mixed bill. It was Josie, actually, again. Mm-hmm. And like Stephen Scopley, who's a great character comic. And Mae Martin, who's an amazing comedian. We all just became drawn to Sam because he's one of those performers. He's just doing his own thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, just seems to be like, right, this, you know, he's just got that clear vision of this, you know, this is who I am as a comedian. So
I love it.
And,
so
I'm
going to wrap this episode up by saying, if you are going to the Edinburgh Fringe this year, which I recommend, you should definitely go and see Sage Francis and B Dolan are doing a show together.
Oh, great! I didn't
know
that.
Which is going to be absolutely amazing. It's a spoken word show, but together.
Wow.
From what I've heard, it's going to be stunning. I'm there doing a distraction pieces, but the main point of that is the book's out and I've booked a day off where I just want to get as many comedians on the podcast as possible. So there's that. But go and see Sam Campbell. Rob Alton. Obviously, James A. Caster. Obviously, is Brett there? I don't know. Brett's there.
Brett's
this year.
Not
he's
there
just
this
got
year.
His big TV show in America, isn't he? He's a big shot now.
He's going to... I think he's a bit busy. But
Who else would you recommend?
Nish Kumar. Rose Matafeo. Mae Martin's doing a work in progress.
And Nish Kumar is someone I've heard loads about and haven't seen anything of yet.
Yeah, Nish is really, really good.
Yeah.
Really, really funny and thought-provoking political comedy.
Brilliant.
Joel Dommett is going to be doing the festival this year. Holly Byrne is always amazing. I always recommend Holly Byrne to people. There's too many acts to recommend, really. But
that's
like,
great. That's a good run there that you can... Can note in the Fringe. In fact, if you are listening to this on Acast, as we mentioned each of them, and you can go back, we will have put up a link to their page on the Fringe, kind of in the Fringe program.
Great.
So you can click there and see when they're playing, or where they're playing, and all that. Otherwise, you can just go and look them up yourself, you lazy pricks. But but other than that, that's great. So thank you very much. Where can people keep up to date on everything that you're doing from the BBC Three TV show?
Yeah.
Sounds random. To the Fringe, to touring and all that.
On my Twitter, really, it says at James A. Caster.
I like your website as well. You've got
thanks, man. I like
it.
Yeah,
website.
I don't update it enough. The gigs get updated quite regularly, but I don't do anything else. But jamesacaster.com is the website, and that's got my tour dates on it for this new show, which will be touring in the autumn.
Twitter and all that kind of
Twitter,
all the usual places.
Stuff like that. And mainly at the minute, I'm tweeting about. I've done a web series called Sweet Home Lahnsteiner Ringer, where me and a camera crew have visited Lahnstein, which is Kettering's twin town, and each episode is a different part of
amazing.
That.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
Oh, I need to watch that. Well, thank you very much, sir. It's been a delight catching up and talking.
Thanks,
thank you,
man.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Distraction Pieces.
There you go. That was episode 104 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with James Acaster. Yeah, as we mentioned, there's some great Edinburgh Fringe recommendations there. I can't recommend them enough, particularly Sage Francis and B. Dolan. It's going to be a hell of a show. I'm so excited about having them at the Fringe. I love the Fringe. And for Americans, the Fringe is quite a weird thing because it's all in one place. It's unusual. Yeah, I think it's going to be great. So please, I recommend you buy tickets for that. And of course, I've got my book tour, which I mentioned at the start. It's been amazing how well the tickets have been selling for that. Stamford's already sold out. Brighton and Birmingham keep coming up as sold out, but it's the allocation thing, so they're trying to up the allocation and get as many in there as possible. Edinburgh is very nearly sold out. London is, of course, the big one. So, as I mentioned before, I'm hoping as many of you as possible can make it along to that. We're going to have some surprise guests. Hopefully, Chris and Stu from the Drunk Casts are going to come along and be on there. Maybe my mum and dad, who've been previous guests, are going to come along. And they'll be there as well if you want them to sign the books and things like that. And the good thing, I've had a lot of people asking about, why aren't you coming to Oxford or Norwich or insert any name there. The good thing about the London one is it's over, I think it'll be 10 o'clock at the latest, so you're in time for the last train home. The fact is we had 10... shows, or I had 10 days I could fit it all in, essentially. So I've gone to as many places as possible. Like, we're not in Yorkshire, but the thought was, if I do Manchester, you know, York and Leeds and many others can get to and from on the train and so on and so forth, and hopefully Edinburgh will open up, kind of Newcastle and things like that. It's obviously we can't get everywhere. Brighton will open up, Southampton and Portsmouth, Bristol will hopefully open up, a bit of Cornwall. So yeah, hopefully we'll have people come along and get the trains home or whatever else. But again, we've gone as many places as possible. Next week's podcast is going to be fantastic. It's with Jordan from Rizzle Kicks. I think you're going to love it. It's a fascinating chat. He's doing some really cool solo stuff at the moment, which I think a lot of you would like, called A Wild Hood. And then the week after that is one that I've hyped a few times. I'm going to have Thomas Coles on, who's worked with me on all of the music videos from Introduction onwards. And we're going to do it in two parts, one part now, one part later on in the year, kind of autumn. And we're just going to go through a video at a time and give some behind-the-scenes information, some background on them and things like that. And I think it'll be a really interesting one. So check those out in the next couple of weeks. But most of all, come along to the book tour. I cannot wait. Yes, on to next week. Thank you for tuning in. Subscribe, all that other good stuff. I should also mention... Say Why to Drugs in particular has been going absolutely mental. The MDMA episode just went nuts. The alcohol episode, I think, is the most downloaded episode. It's a great podcast on the network. Tuesday Night Jaw and Stop and Search. Also, there's loads of good podcasts on the network. In June, we had over 450,000 downloads or listens on the network. I think it's 461,000 and something. So it's crazy. That's a lot, man. And that's because of you guys supporting. So thank you for tuning in. Also, I'm ending with big love for Chris Jericho, who had me on his podcast and put it out last week. And the love I've got from that has been fantastic. So thank you for tuning in. I'm actually going to end now. This intro seems like it's going on forever. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.